DR Power Equipment has given homeowners the power to do more with powerful field and brush mowers capable of clearing acres of grass and brush. Trimmers that deliver up to 5 times more power than any ordinary handheld model. And chippers that turn nuisance brush piles into beneficial mulch. Start doing more this season with equipment from DR Power. Visit drpower.com today and shop the sale.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's essential prenatal multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm GTR of The Nation magazine, which sponsors the podcast, which is widely available on all podcasting platforms. This week, I want to return again to the sort of issue of Donald Trump's foreign policy in the Middle East, which we've often hit upon in previous programs, but which I think is very important. And I think it's one of the areas where the president has the most sort of leeway and freedom. And we're seeing sort of like very interesting developments. Once again, I'm very happy to have on Trita Parsi, who's the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute, and who's a longtime observer of these issues. So I guess where I maybe want to get started is the whole issue of Trump's relationship with the regimes in the region. You know, it's becoming very controversial because of this, you know, what looks to be a very dubious donation by Qatar of a jumbo jet to Trump. But I think, you know, Trump sort of prizes himself on his ability to personal deal-making ability and his relationships. And some of these relationships are maybe a little bit unexpected. And I want to actually start with his relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu and with the Israeli government, because I think Trump is doing certain things that I think not everybody expected from him. Do you want to like maybe elaborate on that?
Sure. Let me first say, you know, I see significant challenges and problems with not only this, but many other types of gifts that have been given. There's protocols for how this should happen. I would say, though, that the real issue behind the campaign on making this a very big issue has far less to do with corruption and far more to do that there is a campaign run by the Israelis right now to try to discredit Steve Witkoff, Oman,
yeah,
Qatar, essentially any entities that are involved in trying to get a ceasefire or trying to make peace between the U.S. and Iran. These are all seen as threats by the current Israeli government. You have many of their mouthpieces and proxies going out there viciously attacking Steve Witkoff, running a campaign against Qatar. They tried to run a campaign against Oman once it became clear to them that Oman was going to mediate the conflict between the U.S. and Iran on the nuclear issue. They've not put as much fuel into that as they have into other things. So I think that is the actual picture. That does not mean that these gifts, et cetera, are not problematic, but I don't think that is the real reason as to why a lot of noise has been raised about that issue.
Yeah, no. I want to return to that because I do actually think that there's a very kind of, as you suggest, an interesting sort of subtext to all this. And one sees this also in the kind of complaints about Qatari gifts to American universities. And it does seem like for a particular type of American Zionist, the complaint is that they're being outbid. There's like the sort of fields of influence and money that is undercutting their own power. So but let's maybe like circle back to that in a second. But I mean, because I mean, what you're suggesting also points to where I want to get to, which is there's an interesting divide that's opening up between the Trump White House and the Israeli government. And I don't think that that's something that people necessarily expected. That I think there was a kind of school of thought that, you know, Trump, because of the, you know, large donations that he took from people like Miriam Adelson, was kind of beholden to the Israeli state and would not challenge it. And I don't think that we're quite seeing that. We're seeing something.
I think we are and we're not. I think what was that we had a bit of a cartoonish assessment of Trump that made us blind to some things that were quite clearly out in the open that we could have paid attention to if we wanted to, more or less. So I think, for instance, he had sent clear signals that he wanted to get a deal with the Iranians, which is completely going against what the Israelis have wanted and what Adelson has wanted. He even said certain things on Gaza, in which he said that he wanted the fighting to end. And it was actually because of him and Witkoff and the pressure that they put on Netanyahu that the first ceasefire was secured. Now, unfortunately, they didn't sustain that pressure. And as a result, Netanyahu was allowed to break the ceasefire. That was a huge mistake. But we've seen essentially that Trump, at the end of the day, has the ability to say no to the Israelis, push back hard against the Israelis on issues that he finds important to him. Mm-hmm. Right now, he does not seem to be in the mood of being cornered into a war with Iran. And also, we saw that he realized that going into the Yemen campaign was a mistake, and he quickly ended it without coordinating with the Israelis. And then when an Israeli journalist asked him, what about the Houthi attacks against Israel? Will they continue? And what do you do if they do? And he said, I don't care about that. And he has shown signs of this before as well. But then on other issues that I think he cares less about, or that he feels is aligning with broader interests that he has, such as going after Harvard, going after students on campuses, then he's doing exactly what Miriam Adelson and her crowd wants him to do. And I think in his view, he's balancing it. They don't have a right to complain because he gave them first Stefanik at the UN and then later on moved Waltz up there. I mean, he's allowing the UN ambassador position to essentially be a position for anyone with strong pro-Israel credentials to take advantage of that and use the UN seat just to veto resolutions against Israel, which, again, I don't think Trump cares about. So he sees it as a rather cost-free concession to those donors.
I would add, like, that's not unique to Trump. Like, I think that has been how many previous administrations, I think going back at least to Nixon, have used the United Nations.
Yeah, to various degrees, of course. And I think you're right. This is not new. I think what is new is this willingness, an unapologetic willingness to push back against Israel when he believes that what they're pushing for is not in his interest. And there we've seen a clear deviation. We see a deviation in Syria. We see a deviation with Erdogan in Turkey. We see a deviation with Iran. We're seeing a deviation with Qatar and Oman. We see a deviation in Yemen. And we're also starting to see a deviation when it comes to hostages and Gaza. And I believe actually that deviation on Palestine and Gaza actually can become much bigger than it has been so far. And this is, I think, the big difference with Biden. No one could make a compelling argument based on data that Biden or Harris had the willingness and the ability to shift gears on Israel. Whereas on Trump, you could make that argument, and you could make it compelling, and you could make it in two directions. You could say that much indicates that he can go in a much worse direction, but he could also go in the opposite direction. There was nimbleness, flexibility, there was uncertainty. Whereas with Biden and Harris, I think it was clear certainty. There was not going to be much movement whatsoever. Didn't matter how much genocide the Israelis committed, didn't matter how much they undermined U.S. interests. They were locked into that. And that was the difference. It was a risk with Trump, but there was also a potential reward.
Yeah, no, I mean, Biden's policy was no daylight of a very sort of like, you know, extreme sort. Like, I don't think there are very many American administrations that would have gone along with Israel to the extent that Biden did. But I think it's also the case that even before Biden, one really hasn't seen, like, you know, an administration that's openly willing to challenge Israel and to openly, say that the United States has its own interest that are separate from Israel since, like, Bush Sr., right? Like, I think that there's actually Trump in some ways is returning to a kind of older Republican realism, that sees Israel as an important ally and asset in maintaining hegemony in the region, but also sees the United States as, you know, having very distinct interest and occasionally needing to openly challenge Israel. Like, do you think that's right?
I would say I think that's largely true. I would make one distinction, though. I think Bush Sr. nevertheless had some sort of a feeling towards Israel. I mean, I think, as you said, saw Israel as an ally. I think, frankly, Trump is quite indifferent, not for, not against. He's much more fixated on what he thinks is his own interest. And as a result, his position on this can very easily shift if the circumstances change and he suddenly finds himself in a scenario in which he thinks that what the Israelis are arguing for is also in his interest, then he'll quickly realign. I don't think there's like an enmity towards Israel that is motivated him. But I think what has happened is that there is a base, an America First base, that he's very sensitive to, who have really taken on the position that the United States should not get involved in more wars, that those wars are not just only wrong, they're also really strong distractions to what they consider to be much more important priorities, such as securing the border, fentanyl, et cetera. Whether there's a connection between the two or not is a different story. In their perception, all of these other things are distractions from those real issues. And as a result, any engagement in these wars will be very badly received in that crowd. And he is sensitive to what that crowd thinks.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think that is a kind of more of an old right position preceding someone even like Bush Sr., who had an internationalist orientation. I mean, it is the kind of old right belief that, you know, like one should look after domestic stuff more importantly than any foreign policy issue. And I think that actually helps reconcile the why he's on the one hand willing to go along with or not even willing to go along with, very eager to join in with the campaign against pro-Palestinian students, because that's perfectly congruent with the kind of America First vision and that kind of like xenophobia and nationalism, but not interested in these kind of like foreign wars.
Yeah. And I think, so for instance, you know, if you take a look at his first term, he started off with a Muslim ban. So when they're coming in saying, hey, you know, go after these students, they're not asking him to do anything differently. They're just asking him to shift the focus of something he was largely planning to do anyways, to start off with the campuses rather than starting off more randomly with more or less anyone. So I think where they are successful is that when they are pushing on open doors. When they're not, then they're running into walls. Whereas with Biden, everything was an open door for him.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's makes a lot of sense. And in terms of we can talk. It might be useful to like kind of articulate how this is playing out within the administration itself, because it does seem like there's a kind of sort of subterranean civil war within the administration between some of the appointees who are like more traditional sort of Republican foreign policy hawks with a kind of like neoconservative orientation and who did like, you know, have want America much more engaged in the Middle East and with a strong alignment towards Israel as against these America First types. And it seems like, you know, we've seen a kind of like a round of hits on both sides with people being let go of the administration. And one sees in the sort of the right-wing press a lot of like sort of factional fights of like targeting different individuals based on their alignment, both from the sort of neoconservative press and the America First Press. So I just wanted to get your sense of like how you think that's playing out, like in terms of like, is there a kind of like civil war within the administration? And yeah, like how's it shaking out in terms of who has dominance?
I don't know if I would go as far as to call it a civil war, but I think you're quite right in pointing out that there's some very deep differences. And those differences combined with a manner in which Waltz was essentially coordinating with the Israelis is the reason why he was fired. And it wasn't just on Iran. It was very much about Yemen as well.
Yeah.
And from the very beginning, it was clear that Waltz was on thin ice because he was on a different page from Trump on Ukraine, on Gaza. Well, actually, not so much on Gaza, perhaps, on Yemen and on Iran. And it was just clear that at some point, something had to give. And I think the signal gate, the failure in Gaza, in Yemen, combined with revelations of his communications with the Israelis is what led to this firing. At this point, I think in many ways, the upper hand is with the more restraint-oriented elements in the administration. But the other side still have some strong cards. I mean, Rubio is pushing, and I think somewhat successfully, for a different direction on the Iran deal that I think will be quite a failure and is already leading the negotiations down a dead end. And so on that issue, despite the fact that things have moved generally in the right direction with negotiations, we're seeing some complications. But Rubio is, I would say, you know, he's not engaged in those matters in the way that Waltz was, with like coordinating with Israelis and things of that nature. And he's been very successful and clever in how he's positioning himself vis-a-vis Trump in a way that has been endearing himself to Trump in a way that has surprised a lot of people, given where he used to be, which was way more of a neocon than almost anyone else in that administration.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one can sort of see this because Trump keeps giving Rubio jobs. I think Rubio currently holds 4 positions. He's the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, in charge of the National Archives. And
more or less in charge of what's going on the campuses as well.
Yeah. What you're pointing towards is kind of like Rubio's actions on Iran. You have actually a very good piece in the American Conservative, which I'll link to in the show notes. But I think it's worth maybe like spelling that out a little bit more, because I mean, I think Trump has said that he's interested in like making a deal with Iran. There are talks going on, and Trump has been very positive about them. And I think the, you know, Iranians have been positive, you know, like cautiously positive about the fact that talks are going on. And again, this is kind of a shift from Biden in a very positive direction. I mean, I think it was a great disappointment to many of us that Biden did not like try to revive the Iran nuclear talks that had been carried out under Obama and that Trump had torn up. But having said that, like as you said, there are elements within the administration that might want to make it very difficult for these talks to succeed. So can you want to spell out more exactly what are the kind of roadblocks that are being created?
Yeah, so first of all, I think you're absolutely right. Trump is willing to talk. He's willing to deal. He's willing to put sanctions relief on the table. He's willing to say positive things about the Iranians, all kinds of things that that Biden really did not want to do. I think Biden's own envoy to this, Rob Malley, nailed it when he said that one of the big differences as to why Trump may very well end up becoming successful is the fact that he's eager to get the deal. And at best, Biden was lukewarm. You're not going to get a deal with Iran on a tough issue like this if you're not really committed. And this is one of the key differences. When it comes to these type of institutionalized enmities, such as the one between the U.S. and Iran, 40 plus years of enmity, a bureaucracy on both sides that generates and produces more and more people who know how to further strengthen that enmity rather than to dismantle it. To change that, you need to have a tremendous amount of political will, which means that you have to be committed. You have to be willing to pay the political price. Biden had none of that. He may have wanted a deal, but he wanted it for free. He wanted it without paying a political price at home. To him, a deal with Iran was not desirable. It was something you had to do out of pure necessity. for Trump, he has this fascination of making deals with countries that the U.S. has not been on good terms with, ending enmities, being a peacemaker. Whether he ends up being that or not is a different story, but that is what he seems to be fascinated by. So he much rather make a deal with Putin, with Kim Jong-un, and with Khamenei in Iran than to strike a new deal to strengthen the alliance with Germany, right? Whereas all of Biden's energy was into strengthening the existing alliance system.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm glad you made that point, because I think that that is actually the key kind of difference of like worldview. And like when one listened to Biden talk, he was always going on about how he made like NATO stronger than it's ever before, made AUKUS stronger than ever before. And to some degree, I mean, like, you know, making peace with your friends, like, is like a limited achievement in foreign policy. Like, the whole point of diplomacy is how you can get along with people that you have problems with.
Exactly. But he's coming at this from this mindset, this Cold War mindset, in which the world is divided. And there's nothing you can do to change that. All you can do is to strengthen your side within that division. And Trump is coming in not having particularly strong views on these things at all, but just looking for opportunities. And where's the opportunity? The opportunity is where you have the worst relationship and you can actually move it the furthest. That's an opportunity. But just changing something marginally by making Germany slightly more of an ally than it was before is of very little interest to him.
Yeah, yeah, no. I think that's right. And in fact, I mean, he sort of sees allies as parasites that are freeloading.
Yeah, and that's a very important dimension of this as well, which he believes that much of the alliance system has ended up taking advantage of the U.S. It's the politics of grievance. And I think a lot of that is exaggerated, but I think at this point, no one is questioning the fact that there's been a lot of free riding in Europe on American security. And then you take it back to where that base is. And the base believes that the combination of the American foreign policy establishment and the alliance system is what has brought the U.S. into all of these unnecessary wars that actually don't matter to U.S. national interests.
Yeah. So I mean, it is a kind of very sort of a coherent point of view. And I think, like, especially for people on the left, it's important to acknowledge, like, how it's actually works and its own internal logic. Now, having said that, like, I think that, like, for me, the critique on Trump that I always made was, like, not necessarily on disagreeing with the idea that, you know, one should negotiate with hostile regimes and one should, like, be open to, like, deal making. For me, it was the question of, like, does he have the ability to implement it? And in the first term, I thought that it was a real problem that he constantly appointed people who didn't share his own worldview and who were, in fact, were willing to, were much more traditionalist foreign policy hawks, like, you know, John Bolton, and, you know, who basically blocks Trump in repeatedly, you know, like preventing him from making the kind of moves that he wanted to make. And so for me, I think that remains a kind of like open question that one sees on the one hand, I think in Trump, a very welcome desire to make deals, but he doesn't necessarily have the kind of savvy in terms of control of bureaucracy that you need to have, like, to actually implement things that someone like, you know, Nixon and Kissinger had when they were able to override, you know, the foreign policy bureaucracy that was committed to the Cold War against both the Soviet Union and China, or that, you know, even someone like Obama had the sort of, you know, both the sort of tenacity and commitment and understanding of bureaucracy to override the institutions in terms of dealing with Cuba and Iran. Like, so for me, that's the open question. Like, does Trump have what it takes?
I think that's an excellent point. And we're seeing it already now in the first, what is it now, 5 or so months of this. He comes in strongly. He gets a ceasefire in Gaza, cannot sustain the pressure, cannot sustain the attention, and then leaves all kinds of openings that Netanyahu took advantage of. And then they back off, right? He goes into Yemen, but thankfully, he decides to get out once he realizes that it's a trap, whereas other presidents would probably feel committed to it and would feel that it's embarrassing to pull out. On Iran, I think that's a very valid concern as well. And I think we have now ended up in a situation in which some of the entities who are against the deal are starting to feel a little bit more comfortable. They think that perhaps he will strike a deal, but the deal will collapse because he will not sustain it. We have seen similar things, you know, in his movement on Ukraine as well. And again, it goes back to partly what you said, not knowing how to, you know, work with the bureaucracy or even work against the bureaucracy, but also they are not staffed to handle a lot of these different things. And he shifts his focus back and forth from issue to issue. And all of the major principals have to follow his focus from this issue to that issue instead of doing the follows through that is so critical here. And so I think that is a major, major challenge. He has an almost unprecedented ability to just go in and strike when things are hard and just make a deal and break old patterns, but not the ability or the follow through to make sure that those changes actually stick.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it seems like to me that's like what a kind of a major concern. I think it's a major concern not only if you're like the United States, but like if you're like one of these foreign countries, because I think from the point of view of like a sort of like a Putin or a Khomeini or President Xi in China, like, you know, you might be thinking, well, you know, Trump is saying some very interesting things. We can make a deal, but like, can he, will the United States follow through on this, or will they simply revert to their old norms? I mean, it's a question to me, like, how are, these foreign adversaries viewing Trump's ability to do things that he's promising?
This is going to be probably one of the biggest challenges that that he has, because again, as I mentioned earlier on, when you have a bureaucracy that has been sustaining an institutionalized enmity, a decision of a president matters tremendously, but it does not mean that there isn't a tremendous force of inertia that can keep those things reverting back to the way they were before. For instance, one thing that will be very fascinating to see now is he said that he's going to lift all sanctions on Syria. Some of those measures have to go through Congress. That's not going to be an easy process. It's going to have to go through. It's going to be a challenging process. Does he have the determination, the dedication, the patience of seeing through that process? So I think we may very well end up in a scenario in which a lot of designations are lifted, a lot of executive orders are changed, but the CSER Act in and of itself is not necessarily going to be fully lifted because it is a much trickier process to get rid of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I'm glad you brought up sort of Congress, because I do think that that's actually kind of further a weak spot or, you know, a place where we will see pushback. And this, I think, maybe lets us circle back to what we were discussing earlier with, like, you know, this whole political issue now of Trump accepting the gift of the airplane for Air Force One. It seems like that sort of issue is almost perfectly designed to allow a sort of bipartisan mobilization in Congress for the status quo. And one is already seeing, you know, someone like Chuck Schumer, who's been very unwilling to like fight Trump on anything else, but is suddenly like picking up this issue because it's perfectly incongruent with his, like, you know, policy goal of having a bipartisan foreign policy consensus that doesn't shift on like Israel. Like, is Trump like making himself very vulnerable to like sort of congressional pushback?
It all depends. Let's say, for instance, he actually manages to get a nuclear deal with Iran. And that deal is a good deal in his view. It's sufficient on the nuclear front. And then it probably lifts primary sanctions, which will provide benefits for American companies, which I think he is very, very interested in at the end of the day, because he is eager to make sure that the deal is not just opening up business opportunities for non-American companies. Now, that will not be particularly popular with some in Congress. So people like Ted Cruz, Tom Cotton, Lindsey Graham, who are kind of beating the drums of saying zero enrichment, dismantlement, things of that nature, which will never work. What are they going to do in that situation? Are they going to pick a fight and die on that hill fighting Trump on something that he declares to be a signature achievement of his? Where's the constituency in America, in Texas, in Arkansas, for taking on Trump on that issue? That constituency only exists in Washington, D.C., a couple of blocks around me here on K Street, right? There's no constituency for that in the United States that is strong enough. And there's a very strong MAGA constituency, America First constituency, that would be totally in favor of this deal and think that this would be a great achievement. Would Ted Cruz risk his career over this issue? Lindsey Graham is leaving Congress at some point, I assume, so perhaps he will have a different calculation. Will Tom Cotton, who still seems to have fantasies of entering the administration, pick a fight on this issue? I find it unlikely. They may say a couple of things, but are they going to put forward a massive opposition? I don't see it. Perhaps some on the Democratic side would do it, but if that were to happen, I think we will have a completion of the reversal of the turn of the tables of where the Democratic Party actually stands on a lot of issues. It was the Democratic Party that actually, under Obama, which was a very different Democratic Party than we have today, that got the first nuclear deal, that fought against these things, even though Schumer, of course, never voted in favor of the JCPOA. But now, increasingly, the voices that are coming out of that party are sounding like the party has become the party of Liz Cheney on foreign policy. If that's the direction they want to go in, I personally think it would be a disaster. And I think it would be very bad for the left as a whole. And I hope that there's a lot of pushback from the left. But it seems to me that so much of the focus on the left right now is to figure out an effective domestic political message while ignoring foreign policy altogether, which then leaves more space for the hawks within the Democratic Party to take up the empty space and define what the Democratic Party's foreign policy is going to be.
I think that's right. And more particularly, like, I do think that in some ways, to the extent that there is a left foreign policy, the quite proper focus on, like, you know, Gaza and the Palestinians, it has left a vacuum where there's not a discussion of the broader Middle Eastern foreign policy that needs to be in place. And so when it's not seeing a lot of discussions about, you know, the Iran nuclear deal and relationship, you know, with Yemen and with Syria. So I think that's right. What maybe, like, you know, to return to the sort of, you know, these accusations of corruption, like, it does seem like, for, you know, like, Schumer, like, if there's going to be, like, a roadblock, it does seem like someone like Schumer could use the issue of Qatari money to try to win over some hawkish Republicans in Congress and to try to, you know, like, create a coalition. Like, because I do think the desire is to have a kind of, like, bipartisan coalition that is hawkish and then stands in the way of Trump on these policies. So, to me, that seems to be the sort of the pathway where this could go forward. Do you think that, like, I mean, it is interesting, like, so someone like Lindsey Graham, I mean, like, he does seem like, you know, really want to be on Trump's good side.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, anyone who has then taken on Trump in a frontal assault from the Republican side has lost. And there's little that indicates that the prospects of winning is different going forward. So again, if he strikes a deal that he thinks is good, he wants to tout it as a major win, he'll push for it. I don't see a lot of deviation coming from the Republican Party. And since the way INARA works, the bill in Congress that would manage this, it means that he only needs 40 votes in Congress to get it accepted. The Congress has to get a resolution of rejection with a 60-vote bar to kill whatever deal he comes back with. So I don't see the congressional challenge being particularly problematic.
So the real bar would be, like, you know, in terms of the bureaucracy and in terms
exactly of— it would be afterwards making sure that this is properly implemented, that sanctions actually are lifted. I mean, we saw that problem under Obama. Sanctions were lifted, but yet John Kerry had to travel the world and talk to banks and encourage them to actually engage in trade and transactions because they just didn't trust that sanctions really were lifted.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that That makes it a lot of sense. In general, how hopeful are you? Like, it does seem like Trump is eager for a deal, and in many ways, he's willing to break with like the sort of foreign policy conventions that have prevented negotiations from happening, and in particular, is willing to go against kind of like Israel and its complaints. But to my mind, the ability of the Israeli lobby to mobilize in the United States shouldn't be underestimated. And it does seem like, as you indicated before, they are using the issue of like the jets from Qatar and other things to kind of like strengthen their position and to like really weaken the America First forces. So like, what's your sense of how like that might play out?
So no, I have concerns about where things are going in the negotiations, and it is mainly because voices inside the administration has successfully pushed to get Trump to and Trump officials to start talking about things such as zero enrichment, dismantlement, et cetera, as the real objectives. If that is the case, there's not going to be a deal. I just don't see any pathway to a deal under those type of circumstances. So I think in the next couple of meetings, this has to be clarified because otherwise there isn't a basis for a deal. Now, to a certain extent, perhaps this is part of a negotiating tactic, things of that nature. It's very typical for Trump to take excessive positions and then walk them back. But he's also now kind of, or at least his officials have been saying things that may be difficult to walk back. But it's also created confusion in the negotiations. Now, under normal circumstances, this would not necessarily be a huge deal. But in the current circumstances, in which there is a hard deadline of snapback sanctions expiration in October of this year, where the snapback sanctions that the Europeans can snap back at the UN expire, and the Europeans are inclined to use it instead of losing it, then you have a scenario in which time is actually quite limited, and something concrete needs to be achieved before then, in order for the US to say, okay, we don't want snapback sanctions because we have a good deal. And I don't think the Europeans would impose them against Trump's wishes. But bottom line is that this is a hard deadline. If you are trying to extend the deadline, then you're entering into a completely different negotiation in which you have to, your time would be consumed by, instead of actually getting a nuclear deal, getting a new UN Security Council resolution with the Europeans, Chinese, and the Russians, all on the same side, extending that deadline, setting aside Ukraine. So you're essentially swapping a tough negotiation with Iran for an impossible negotiation with Russia and the EU. That makes no sense to me. And that's why I think they need to move really fast right now before those dynamics take over the situation.
Yeah, in terms of like our earlier framing, like as to whether Trump can pull it off, like it does seem to me that with this hard deadline, like this is going to be a real test. Like, like whether Trump has the sort of competence and the his administration is in line enough with what he wants to do to actually pull this off. And I think I mean, I'm glad you highlighted this because I think it kind of gives us a good way of gauging, like can this actually work? More broadly, I just we just have a few minutes left. I wanted to in terms of like the sort of transactional nature of Trump's relationship, it does seem like he's very interested, both like an ideological level and I think maybe a personal financial level, with relationships with like the Arab autocracy, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and whatnot. And I wanted to know what you thought of how the Abraham Accords stand, because it seems to me that they're kind of being redefined. That I think the normalization of relationships with Israel is kind of like being dropped as a consideration, and so it seems like one might get some version of the Abraham Accords, but is very different than what anybody was expecting. I don't know what you think of that.
No, I think the Trump administration will continue to try to talk about the Abraham Accords and use that as some sort of a gold standards that they want. But I do have to say that it's your observation is quite clear. At this point, Trump has dropped it. He struck a deal with the Houthis without even telling the Israelis about it. He is going forward with several elements of an agreement with Saudi Arabia without an Israeli component. Now, having said that, these Saudis are not getting what they were asking for and almost got from Biden, which was a defense pact. And we don't know yet exactly what the nuclear concession that the Saudis asked for, which under Biden meant that they would actually be given enrichment capabilities, if that is part of this nuclear deal that Trump is talking to the Saudis about right now. So on the one hand, they're not doing the Israel thing. On the other hand, Trump is not offering at all as much as Biden was. And I have to say, what Biden was offering was stunningly shocking.
Yeah, it was.
The idea that, you know, I mean, I was always very negative towards the Abraham Accords, but Trump never offered concrete treaty level security guarantees to any of the countries that joined the Abraham Accords. But Biden was willing to do that with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. And again, I think that goes back to the different visions. I mean, like, I think Biden did believe in creating these kind of like defense pacts, you know, like it is of a piece with his commitment to NATO and AUKUS, like, you know, like trying to create, security umbrella alliance in the Middle East of a sort that I think you and I and I think many of our listeners would be rightly skeptical if that's in like anyone's interest. So it seems like whatever the Abraham Accords might have once been, they're being redefined as a more like loose, transactional relationship with different countries and not the kind of like tight and I think very dangerous defense.
Yeah. And the one country that is weak enough to go along with it right now is Syria under Jolani. But I I'm not an expert on Syria, but I do question the sustainability of that for the new leadership in Syria, in the sense that Israel is already not only occupying the Golan, they've added another occupation in Syria, in a territory larger than Gaza. They're bombing everywhere in Israel, in Syria. They've already destroyed almost all of Syria's military capabilities. And whereas that weakness may prompt the current government to want to try to get some sort of thing that stabilizes the situation, in the long run, I suspect that Syrian nationalism will be quite unforgiving of a deal that essentially grants Israel de facto annexation, de jure annexation of Syrian land, not just the Golan Heights, but the additional territory. And so I'm a little bit skeptical as to how that will work out for them. But I understand that given the severe weakness that they have right now, they may out of desperation be willing to do it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, like the Syrian situation is definitely in flux. But I don't know if it's like in American interest to have such a weak Syrian regime. You know, like it might well be in Israel's interest, but again, this kind of points that there's not necessarily a shared vision of the world. On that note, I want to thank Trina Parsi once again for being on the program. A very enlightening discussion.
Thank you so much for having me, as always.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.